All right, you are listening to the Four Kings of Boxing podcast. This is chapter two. We are talking about Marvelous Marvin Hagler. I'm your host, the Mandated Reporter, and frankly, I'm mortified, Mr. Mark Rattledge. And joining me on this journey through the Four Kings of Boxing is Baron Von Awesome, Mr. Pat Mullen. How do you do, sir?
I'm great, Mark. Great to hear from you. Very excited. Maybe my favorite show we're ever going to do.
Tell me about Marvin Hagler. You say, I know his passing affected you really badly. He seems to be one of your favorite boxers. Just give me some words on Mr. Hagler. Mr. Marvin
Hagler. No, not one of them. He was number one by far. Marvin was my favorite fighter of all time. As a kid, before I really developed an interest in boxing, there were a few guys here and there that I would want to watch fight. And I saw his fight with Thomas Hearns, who we'll talk about on ESPN's Super Bouts that you may remember. They used to air in the late 80s into the mid 90s. They used to have a show that showed classic fights. And whenever Marvin was on it, I just wanted to watch it. He just had something about him that drew me to him. And I just was mesmerized by Marvin. I loved the way he fought. I loved his attitude, the way he carried himself, the way he fought. And I just wanted to learn more and more about him and watch all his fights that I could. And it got to the point where I watched so much Marvin Hagler that when I finally started boxing when I was 11 years old, I fought more naturally as a left-handed fighter because I was so used to seeing him and trying to mimic him and thinking that that's how you should fight, that even though I'm right-handed, I just naturally gravitated toward fighting the same way he did.
That's interesting that your stronger hand wasn't the hand that you wanted to fight with just based on you watching this other person fight.
Which is, of course, the way he fought, too, as a naturally right-handed guy, but fought more often than not as a southpaw, though he could switch, especially when he was younger.
We actually had him scheduled for chapter three. We switched these around. What was your thinking? Why did we bump up Marvin Hagler?
He turns pro before Leonard and Hearns, so kind of in keeping with the timeline of going by which they make their pro debuts, we'll kind of go with that. Obviously, Duran being the first out of all of them, and Marvin's going to be the next to make the jump into the pro ranks.
Okay, let's get into Marvin's history here. So people who have heard our boxing series on heavyweights and then the first Duran show, those were all strictly audio. This is now a split audio visual thing. So what we've got for the visual audience is a playlist of fights that Pat sent me. Now, this isn't new for me. It might be new to you, but it's not new for me. Pat always sends me fights to watch. It's part of the conversation that we're having. Like, hey, you should watch these fights. And, you know, we can study up on them. We can talk about them. In this particular case, we're going to run them as we're talking about this. They may not always line up with the part of the conversation that we're having, but I think it's a fun thing to kind of, if you're watching this on YouTube, it's a fun thing to look at. So this first one here is highlights from the Marvin Hagler, Eugene Hart match. And we're going to get to that in just a moment. But first, before he was Marvelous, he was born Marvin Nathaniel Hagler in Newark, New Jersey's Notorious Central Ward on May 23rd, 1954. Hagler's age was often questioned until he legally changed his name to Marvelous Marvin Hagler in 1982. Hagler was the eldest of six children, both out of wedlock, to Ida Mae Lang. His youngest sibling, Robbie Sims, would also be a top 10 rated middleweight contender through the 1980s. Hagler dropped out of school at the age of 14 to work at a toy factory to help support a family held together by his mother working three jobs in order to support herself and her children. As a youth, Marvin idolized former heavyweight champion Floyd Patterson, who we talked about in a previous podcast. Check that out in the archives in our History of Heavyweight Boxing series. And two division world champion, Emil Griffith. Following the Newark riots, Hagler's mother moved the family to Brockton, Massachusetts, the home of former heavyweight champion Rocky Marciano. See my previous statements about heavyweights, and a city rich with boxing history. At the age of 16, Hagler was at a party when he had a run-in with an amateur boxer whom he would cross paths with in the professional ranks. Darnell Wigfall. Wigfall beat Marvin up and literally took the jacket off of his back. A determined Hagler refused to ever let that happen again, as you would, if he went to a boxing gym owned by Vinny Vecchione, unbeknownst to Hagler, where Wigfall trained. Hagler sat down and waited and watched without being approached by anyone. The next night, Hagler crossed the street to a gym owned by Goody and Pat Petronelli. Goody had been an amateur champion in the Navy with brother Pat owned a construction company that funded the gym. In 1969, they had made an agreement with Rocky Marciano to open the Marciano Gym, which would carry Rocky's name and see Goody train fighters while Pat ran the business end. Tragedy struck when Rocky was killed in a plane crash that same year. The brothers persevered and opened Petronelli Brothers Gym. At the same time, Marvin Hagler would walk through their doors for the first time. Marvin sat down after a few minutes, and he was approached by Goody, who asked him, "You looking to learn how to box?" To which Hagler replied, "This is what I'm here for." Goody did what he did with every kid looking to learn to fight. He sat Marvin down and told him that boxing can build character, self-respect, discipline, and keep him in shape and out of trouble. But on the other side, he was going to get hit, and he wasn't going to like it. I feel like I've had that same conversation with my son, like almost word for word. But if he could put up with it, he might be in the right place. Goody told him to come back the next night and bring his gear, which at the time consisted of a pair of cut-off jean shorts and old tennis shoes. Goody noticed that Marvin picked up things very quickly in comparison to other amateur hopefuls. Goody asked him what he was doing, and Hagler said he was practicing at home, meaning he was looking in a full-length mirror and repeatedly throwing punches and combinations and moving. Because of the use of the mirror, Hagler found himself fighting more naturally as a left-handed fighter, but was still able to switch to a conventional right-handed stance, effectively making him an ambidextrous fighter. We're talking about there is shadow boxing. A word, Pat, on the nature of shadow boxing and how it helps you as a fighter.
Shadow boxing is useful for the purposes, one, of building up your wind, because it takes a lot more energy to throw a punch and miss than it does to throw a punch and land it. So you shadow box to warm up, but also condition yourself to throwing punches that don't make connections so that you're not going to wear yourself out. It's going to help your reflexes. It's going to help loosen you up. It's going to help you, by muscle memory, just become familiar with how you should throw a punch, where you should throw a punch, why you should throw a punch, and just build that repetition in your muscle memory and build your reflexes and your wind all together to make you a better fighter.
Yep, makes sense. Hagler lied about his age in order to compete in amateur tournaments. In the 1973 National Golden Gloves Tournament, Hagler was defeated in the middleweight finals, while in the welterweight finals, a young Sugar Ray Leonard would win the championship and be voted outstanding boxer of the tournament. However, in November of that same year, Hagler would capture the AAU National Middleweight title and be voted outstanding boxer of the tournament, while future rival Leonard, who we will talk about in a later chapter, would lose his finals bout. After winning the AAU title, a decision had to be made regarding Hagler's future. He could either begin training for a 1976 Olympic berth or turn professional and start earning money. A hungry Hagler didn't want to wait another 2 years, I don't blame him, for the Olympics, and threw his hat into the professional ring, adding a menacing look of a completely bald head to go with his goatee and chiseled physique. Hagler turned pro with a second round KO win of Terry Ryan, earning $50 for his fight.
$50 for his pro debut. Keep that in mind.
In comparison, future rival Leonard would earn $40,000 for his pro debut. Seems a little uneven, Pat. What happened there?
An Olympic gold medal and a very high profile network presentation of one guy versus the other.
Yep. Undeterred. Marvin, why are you so mad? Well, here's the list. Undeterred, Hagler mounted win after win, including a decision and KO win over former tormentor Darnell Wigfall before a big break beating 1972 U.S. gold medalist Sugar Ray Seals, as opposed to Sugar Ray Leonard.
Yeah, and at one point, everybody named Ray was just calling themselves Sugar.
Nice. However, Hagler was unable to lure a big name to fight him in New England, in the New England area, due to due to Petronelli's lack of connections and to Hagler being a high-risk fight. As Joe Frazier, good old Smokin' Joe, told the young Hagler, he had three strikes against him. You're good. You're black. You're a southpaw. Hagler and the Petronellis made the decision to begin fighting at the Philadelphia Spectrum, a veritable lion's den of middleweights from the 1960s and 70s. Hagler's first Philadelphia excursion resulted in his first professional loss, a highly controversial decision, to Philadelphia's Bobby Boogaloo Watts. Watts was a tall and rangy fighter whom Hagler burrowed in on, pushing to the ropes and beat up on the inside for the majority of rounds. The decision was so bad. How bad was it, Pat?
It was so bad that J. Russell Peltz, who worked for the Spectrum in promotions at the time, helped put the fight together, went to Hagler's backing promoter, Sam Silverman, and literally apologized to him for the decision.
What exactly was brain damaged about this particular these particular judges that they came up with this ludicrous decision?
I wish I knew, including the referee who had, at the time, referees were still the third scoring body along with two judges. And the referee saw it wide for Bobby Watts, which was insane. And the two judges at ringside, they couldn't be, I don't know what they were watching, but if you watch the whole fight, and there's a whole copy of it available, it's without sound, but you can see everything that goes on. And I've watched it. Hagler pushes Watts around for the better part of 7 out of 10 rounds and works him over. Watts maybe wins 3 rounds, give or take. It was a horrible hometown decision.
Hagler would rebound, fortunately, with a quick KO win in Boston and accept another fight in Philadelphia on 2 weeks' notice against Frazier protege Willie the Worm Monroe. In a night that every fighter dreams of, Monroe had his best outing as a professional, outpointing Hagler over 10 rounds. It remains to many the only fight Marvin Hagler ever legitimately lost. After the fight, Hagler said, "I think I still have some things to learn, but Willie already knows them." Hagler scored 2 KO wins on the rebound and in New England before getting matched up against one more Philadelphia killer, Eugene Cyclone Hart, who you see on the video if you're watching this on YouTube. If Hagler couldn't beat Hart, it was very likely he'd have been dismissed as a serious contender, but Hagler did a paint job on him, forcing him to quit on the stool. So what happens, you know, as we see some of the highlights here, Pat, what all happened in this fight of note?
A very motivated Marvin Hagler, knowing that this is potentially a crossroads fight for him, as he's already dropped his first 2 fights in Philadelphia against legitimate against legitimate fighters. And even though one of the decisions wasn't legitimate, it goes down in the record books as a loss. And Marvin needs to right that ship, because if he loses 3 in a row in the Spectrum, they're going to just dismiss him as just another also-ran who was good in New England where he's from but can't win outside of there. So Eugene Hart, who is a tremendous puncher but lacked, you know, some finesse in his game, Hagler fought a real great fight against him, walked him into counters, would back up and walk Eugene into a left hand, then switch to the other side and hit him with a right. And even when Hart hit him with his best stuff, Marvin's known for having one of the most sturdy, solid chins in the history of boxing. So when he was able to take it and then give it right back to Hart, it was discouraging. And Marvin just really beats him up for the better part of 8 rounds and forces him to quit on his stool.
Yeah, and if you're watching this on the video, you can see Marvin just really controlling the fight. I mean, Hart's throwing punches, but Marvin, I mean, look at his legs there. He's bouncing. He's throwing. I mean, he just threw a stiff combination there. You can tell even just this little morsel of the fight that we're watching, who's in control of the fight and who's just in there taking a beating. All right, so next up, after beating Hart, Hagler would get a rematch with Monroe and avenge his defeat in Boston by stopping Monroe in the 12th and final round of their rematch. The wins over Hart and Monroe began to raise public awareness of the fighter. 2 more victories, including one over Roy Jones Sr., would lead to the rubber match with Monroe. In one of Hagler's most devastating performances, he would leave Monroe completely out of it with a devastating one-punch KO. So, talk to me about that, Pat.
Yeah, this one was personal for Marvin. They're 1-1 with each other, and he's got to do something here to set this rivalry apart and really close the book on Willie. And after the second fight, he'd felt like he figured out Willie pretty good. And so they go into this fight, and after a pretty decent first round where each guy kind of has some moments, but it seems like Marvin's just a step ahead, he just bludgeons Monroe with this right hand off of a long left that leads to a right hand along the ropes. And you see Monroe get up and fall back down, get up and fall back down, and he's just out of it. And Goody always referred to it as the Willie Monroe punch because he doesn't know that he ever saw a more devastating Marvin knockout than what Marvin did to Monroe in this fight. And ESPN Friday Night Fights used to always have a classic KO flashback. Mm-hmm. This was a pretty regular spot on that.
This got played often, huh?
Pretty darn often.
It's really funny. All right, so moving on with our story here. Hagler would take five consecutive fights against four ranked opponents, twice carving up England's Kevin Finnegan, bludgeoning Minnesota's Doug Demings, and in a nationally televised bout on CBS, breaking the jaw of fellow New Englander Mike Colbert, and culminating with a 10-round decision over spiritual predecessor and the man many believe to be the best middleweight to never win the championship, Philadelphia's Bad Benny Briscoe, who, if you're watching, you can see on the screen here. Tell us about Marvin Hagler versus Briscoe.
Benny had long been the middleweight championship gatekeeper, and I don't mean that in a negative way. I just meant that if a guy was able to beat Benny, the odds are the guy was ready to contend for the title or be the champion. And that includes he fought Carlos Monzon before Monzon began his long reign as champion. Rodrigo Valdez, who would eventually begin a reign as WBC and then later undisputed champion. Vito Antifermo. Benny fought the best of the best, and he beat a lot of guys along the way. But he was kind of the predecessor to Marvin, and he had the look of the bald head and very menacing and coming at you to hurt you. Except Benny, you know, was not in the same shape Hagler was in and didn't have the goatee. And by this point in time, Benny's on the slide. Like, there's no denying that.
Mm-hmm.
And people are expecting that if Marvin's really this guy that they're talking up, Marvin's going to go in there and do a number on him. And Marvin has a pretty good fight here. He performs well, but he fights very defensively. The reason being, he suffered a very bad cut from a clash of heads early in the fight.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't want to make that situation worse, potentially have the fight stopped on a cut or ruled against him because he's in Philadelphia against a Philadelphia fighter and has already had a taste of home cooking go against him there. And Benny Briscoe is a much higher profile opponent than a Bobby Watts. So there's always the chance that Hagler's in the back of his mind thinking they're going to take this away from me if I give them the opportunity. So he boxes very conservatively, but scores a lot of points. And there's really no way they can't give him this decision, and he wins it.
So moving on to the next thing here. Marvin Hagler versus Sugar Ray Seal. So here's the story on this fight. At the point that we're talking about, Hagler had been ranked the number one contender for over a year, but failed to procure a title shot. Hagler would fight Sugar Ray Seals a third time, finishing his former foe in one round, and traveled to Italy to batter Norberto Cabrera before the Petronellis and Hagler enlisted major legal help to get Hagler his deserved title shot.
Yeah. And you see here, he does a real quick number on Sugar Ray Seals, who ain't so sweet in this fight. we're a minute in, and he's already been down and does not look very sturdy as Marvin just comes along causing carnage and destruction. Just waiting. And that was a jab that hurt him, and an uppercut just nails him and puts him down. And poor Ray is out of it. But there was at the time, Don King was promoting a USA boxing tournament. And he's going to take the best American fighters in each division and have them fight in a tournament-style setting to determine the top American challengers.
Hang on. Jesus Christ.
Yeah. by Ray.
But for people listening on regular podcasts, Marvin Hagler hit this dude with a left, and that guy's brains look like it went out of his ear.
Yeah, we saw the soul leave the body. Don King, old Don, you know, always been the best interest of the people. Was promoting something called the USA Boxing Championships, and he was going to crown the best American fighter in each division and try to get them a world title shot. So they do the middleweight division, and conspicuous by his absence is the number one contender, Marvin Hagler, who's been beating all these great fighters and doing so and looking great and doing it on national TV. Reason being because Marvin didn't want to sign away every single promotional right he had to Don King.
Fair.
Don King, after dealing with Marvin, who told him, "I'm not signing with you, I'm being loyal to the Petronellis," went on an end around to talk to Hagler's mother and tried to sell Ida Mae Lang on the idea that Marvin's black, I'm black, I'm going to look out for him because we're both black and we're not going to be screwed by the white devil. And that incensed Marvin, who at that point swore off anything to ever do with Don King. And of course, anybody who's followed the trials and tribulations of the USA boxing tournament knows that a lot of what was in that tournament was fixed. Records were forged by Ring Magazine.
Really? Ring Magazine was complicit in these shenanigans?
Yes, they were. Al Braverman and Paddy Flood, who were King's two henchmen, were complicit in getting a lot of these fighters to sign over their rights and posing as managers to, you know, make sure King's name stayed clear. And eventually the whole thing came to a head during a fight on national TV on ABC, which was the sponsor between Scott Ledoux, who many people will remember, and a guy named Johnny Boudreaux. After Ledoux pretty much beat the crap out of Boudreaux and got screwed on the decision, Ledoux called out the tournament as being fixed. He said the guy's records weren't legit. And also, in a post-fight scuffle, knocked off Howard Cosell's toupee, which was fantastic. There was a Hagler opponent named Ike Fluellen, who was a Dallas, Texas police officer who hadn't fought in 2 years since losing to Hagler, who mysteriously showed up in the ring's top 10 ratings as soon as this tournament was announced, and he was announced as a part of it.
Wow. Well, as our story continues, hang on. Ugh.
Mark's not great with YouTube, guys.
I'm struggling. All right, so moving on. See, other people edit. I like to call on the ring, and sometimes you trip over your shoelaces. Hagler's lawyer, Stephen Wainwright, petitioned Massachusetts Senator Ted Kennedy and Massachusetts-based Speaker of the House, Tip O'Neill. Both men contacted Bob Arum, head of promotional firm Top Rank, still there today. The old man in the sea still runs Top Rank. That if Hagler did not receive a world title shot against the winner of Hugo Coro versus Vito Antuframo, which you can see on the video, middleweight title fight, that there would be a congressional investigation to that situation.
Remember, think about how sad that is, that that's the level you have to go to get this guy who's been ranked number one to get his shot. He has to petition the Speaker of the House and a state representative to look into potential corruption to try to get this guy a fight for the title that he's been waiting on.
You know, boxing is, I think, one of the best sports in the world. I really do. I really firmly believe that. But, I mean, it is an uphill struggle to maintain any kind of integrity, and it's sad. November 1979, with a record of 46-2-1, Hagler stepped into the ring at Caesar's Palace, Las Vegas, against middleweight champion Vito Antuframo of Brooklyn, New York. The middleweight title fight would actually be the chief supporting bout to a welterweight title fight with champion Wilfred Benitez defending the WBC and lineal titles against undefeated challenger Sugar Ray Leonard. Leonard had made $40,000 for his pro debut, the same amount Hagler would be paid on this night, because Hagler's always following Leonard like Wednesday follows Tuesday. on this night, challenging for the middleweight championship, Leonard's purse would be about $1 million. How Marvin Hagler didn't kill Sugar Ray Leonard the first time they fought is beyond me, given the story that we're telling here.
Given the gross inequities in the parallels?
Yes, sir.
Oh, don't worry. There's plenty more of that we get to go off of, too. But, yeah, Marvin gets his first shot finally after petitioning major legal help from the United States, and goes in there against the upstart champion Vito Antuframo, who nobody believed would beat Hugo Caro, but did. And Vito's just a tough guy from the street, from Brooklyn. He was getting into a lot of street fights until a police officer directed him to the Flatbush PAL, learned how to box there, had a decent amateur career, came up as a pretty tough pro who managed to put some wins together over ranked competition just by work ethic, because Vito wasn't a puncher, had a notoriously bad habit of bleeding all over the place. But Vito was tough, and he was a hard worker, and he was never going to run out of steam, and he was going to pressure you. The problem for him is Marvin loved guys who went to pressure him, because Marvin loved to be the matador and walk guys into counters and fight at long range and then go inside and bust them up when he so chose. So from a stylistic standpoint, this is a perfect matchup for Marvin, because not only that, but Vito's not a puncher. Vito really doesn't have the ability to threaten him. And in the early going, Marvin, who opened as a favorite in this, which one of those rare times the challenger opens as a favorite, fought as the favorite and did everything he was supposed to do. He was working off of his jab, landing combinations, moving out, not letting Vito tie him up and bruise him up on the inside. Antuframo has a good round here or there sparingly until, you know, the late mid rounds. So about 7, 8, 9, he has some momentum go his way. And one thing you got to remember is Marvin had never fought 15 rounds. This is Marvin's first 15-round fight. And I think what the Petronellis tried to do is try to make sure he wasn't going to run out of gas and reined him in a little bit towards those rounds where he did come back with a big rally late in the fight along 13, 14, 15, which were considered the championship rounds. And the only thing he didn't do was finish Vito.
Let's take a pause for the cause here. Talk about one of our, while this fight goes on for a little bit, let's talk about Grammarly. Grammarly is a great tool for Pat and I because Pat sends me lots of notes for these fights that I have to refer back to. And Grammarly is a huge tool for Pat to keep his notes straight and his thoughts coherent and make it so that I can read through this with a seemingly like I know what I'm talking about. Grammarly's AI-powered products help people communicate more effectively. Grammarly helps you write mistake-free on Gmail, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and nearly anywhere else you write on the web. Grammarly corrects hundreds of grammar, punctuation, and spelling mistakes while also catching contextual errors, improving your vocabulary, and suggesting style improvements.
Mostly mine.
To download Grammarly today, go to getgrammarly.com/W2M network. Again, that's getgrammarly.com/W2M network to download Grammarly for free. All righty. While Hagler was dominant in the early and middle rounds, he noticeably slowed in the later stages of the bout, allowing Vito to rally and snag a few rounds before Hagler regained control to close the 15-round bout. Referee Mills Lane told Hagler's corner that when the decision was announced, he wanted to be standing next to Marvin to get a picture of him raising his hand. Inexplicably, the bout would be scored a draw. All right, Pat, why? Why a draw?
I think it's best summed up by the referee, Mills Lane, who was just aghast at the decision based on the fact that he wanted to take a picture with Hagler to, you know, confirm, ah, let's get a picture together. Everything's cool. And again, Marvin, who already has it in the back of his mind that the system is against him and doesn't really need any convincing, maybe never gets more of a validation in that belief than he does on this night, where I forget which one of the judges it was, but one of them literally watched the tape back of the fight and said, we didn't do this right. And acknowledge that he scored the fight poorly, which is very rare that that happens. But you know what it doesn't do? It doesn't make it right because Marvin's still not the champion. And Robbie Sims, Marvin's brother, who was starting to begin his pro career at the time, Marvin's going around, I lost. And Robbie's like, Marvin, you didn't lose. It was a draw. You both won. He goes, I didn't get the belt. I lost. And that was what he tried to impart on Robbie at that time. The plan was for Marvin to marry his then-girlfriend, Bertha, once he won the title, and after some, you know, initial, you know, being pissed off and being robbed and everything, Marvin said, "The hell with it. We're still getting married," and marries his girlfriend Bertha at the time in Caesar's Palace. And at that point, there's a switch in Marvin that just, you know, I can't trust anybody. I can't trust judges. So these are going to be my judges going forward.
Well, calls for a rematch were pretty loud, and Antoine Framo was obligated to defend his title against England's Alan Minter. Minter, like Hagler, was a southpaw, and while he would win a close split decision to take the title from Vito, controversy reigned, as it often does, as it was confirmed via video replay that the referee was signaling ringside judges at the end of every round, calling into question the very dubious scorecard of one judge who gave Minter 13 of 15 rounds. The WBC would order an immediate rematch, and once again, Hagler had fallen out of favor. An angry Hagler, as you would be, was determined to bring his own judges, holding up his fist to indicate he was looking to knock down every man who stood in front of him. Oh, this guy's story, man. It's incredible. So, as we go on, Hagler would destroy top 10 rated Lucif Hamani, knocking him through the ropes to the floor, gaining a long measure of revenge against Boogaloo Watts with a devastating second round KO and winning a dominant but uninspired fight against Mexican Marcos Giraldo, which finally led to Hagler locking horns with middleweight champion Minter, who won his rematch with Antoine Framo by cutting him to ribbons in 8 rounds. Pat, just kind of hit these in order here. You sent them to me to watch. And so what are your thoughts here on Hagler, Hamani, then Hagler, Bobby Watts 2. And then as we get to Hagler versus Minter.
For anybody who's ever wanted to see what would happen if Clubber Lang was a real guy, the knockouts that Marvin unleashes here are pretty much what would happen. You have an angry, yoked up, mean southpaw who's looking to make a statement and does so in absolutely brutal fashion. I mean, you can see Hominy circling here if you're on the video part with us, and he's moving. And Hominy is, you know, built in great shape too. Marvin hurts him with a jab. Marvin's power hand, his lead hand, his jab hand hurts guys, and it hurts Hominy and knocks him off balance and drives him to the ropes. And you see Marvin just go in for the kill. There is the jab right there. Now he's got a hook. Hominy's in all kinds of trouble. He switches to orthodox. It stays on balance. Hits an uppercut. Left, right, ugh, left, right, left, right.
My God.
And Hominy goes from the ropes to the floor. And it looks like a scene out of the beginning montage of Rocky III while Eye of the Tiger's playing as Clubber Lang just destroys guys.
He's like in the lap of one of the judges, I think.
Yes, he is.
Wow. That is impressive. To tell us about, all right, so Hagler Bobby Watts too.
This one's personal for Marvin because he fought Bobby, and, you know, again, in the decision, pretty much everyone acknowledged that Marvin should have won and didn't get. Marvin's on this collision course with just destroying everybody, and Bobby Watts is going to be no exception here. And you can see that where we're at, Marvin's already grinding to the inside against the very long and lanky Watts, who eventually Marvin hires as a sparring partner. Because of his style, but Marvin's just all over him from the start of this fight, and Watts hits him maybe once or twice with his best shots, and Marvin just shakes them off without being fazed. And at that point, Watts says, I don't know what I can do here, and he just starts getting hit pretty often because he's turtling up and only throwing one punch back at a time, and Marvin just starts picking through his guard as soon as he sees an opening. And once Watts feels a little bit brave, Marvin is just on him like a lion on his gazelle, and he hurts him a lot with body shots that open up the head, as is a well-schooled fighter's best friend against the long and rangy guy. You get him against the ropes, hit him in the body so you can open up their head. Marvin does it, and Watts, who throws kind of pawing, I won't discredit Bobby by calling them Logan Paul-esque punches, but he's pawing and flailing a lot, and Marvin is throwing solid, solid shots and getting out of the way of Bobby's stuff with relative ease. And just countering him and timing him. And, oh, what a right hand.
A leaping right hand. I mean, that's why you're out of the movies. One of the things I wanted to say as we watch this video is Marvin Hagler's hand speed throwing combinations is quite the wonder. I mean, we talk about, like, modern fighters, like a Floyd Mayweather. Yeah, this guy's done. Bobby Seals flying right there, knocks him out of the fight. And he looks like a drunk man walking home from the bar. But going back to Hagler for a moment here, yeah, his hand speed is something to behold as he throws his combinations.
Oh, yeah. In Marvin's prime, he really, really was just a magnificent fighter. Just could unleash things so freely and so fluidly that you guys just didn't see shots coming. And when you have a jab that's that powerful, it's real hard to try to figure out, oh, God, if he can hurt me with that, what's he going to do next?
Sure. Well, as our story goes on, the next, he's going to get a title shot against Minter. So
the one and only, England's Alan Minter.
Yes, he had to travel to Minter's backyard of Wembley Arena in London to fight Minter in a fight that would exacerbate Hagler's deep-seated paranoia. I think well-deserved paranoia, if you ask me. Marvin produced three of the most one-sided rounds in boxing history, battering and cutting Minter until the fight was mercifully stopped. All right, Pat. So I have it on the video here. Tell me about this fight.
So I'm going to go grab one of my sponsors real quick because this is just devastation, and I want to enjoy it for all it's worth. Hey, guys, it's summertime, so make sure you relax with a nice Line and Kugel summer shandy.
Perfect.
And where did we leave off, Mark, with Alan Minter and Marvin Hagler?
I was asking you about this. You said there was three rounds of just brutal, brutal action here. I want to know the finer points of this fight, in your opinion.
So Minter, before the fight, made the statement that no black man is going to take my championship.
Yeah.
Which some may rightfully construe as a bit racist. But I don't think he was referring to all black men. I think he was referring to specifically to the one standing in front of him who is, in fact, going to take his title by force.
another thing coming.
Yeah, boy, does he. And Minter, one, is not used to fighting other southpaws, so that's going to play to Hagler's strength. Minter fights very European in that he stands straight up and throws a lot of 1-2s and isn't particularly good on the inside. And you can see he just got belted with about 3 hooks solidly if you're watching this fight on the video. And again, having a very difficult time hitting Marvin, who at this point in time is really at the peak of his powers, where he's just as adept boxing as a matador on the outside as he is slipping punches to get inside and just maul you with power shots. And Minter, just, you know, Minter, to his credit, is not backing up. He's going at him. But as soon as Marvin lets his hands go, he's just eating shots flush. And you can't let a guy who is as fluid a puncher or hits as hard as Marvin find any means of success against you on a regular basis, because it's going to end the fight.
Right. I want to say, for people listening on the podcast, like, oh, they're referring to a video I can't watch, all the videos will be linked in the description. So if you're listening to this on your podcatcher, you know, whether it's Apple or Spotify or whatever, all of the links are in the description to YouTube. You can go back. I also have a playlist on my personal YouTube page you can check out. But yeah, you can.
The gazelle punch, as it's called, from Marvin, that leaping right jab.
There it is. Yeah.
That he just puts his body into and just jolts you with. It's like being hit with a battering ram.
I have to say, Minter doing, at least in the little portion that we're watching here, Minter doing a pretty good job of being able to evade Marvin. But when Marvin makes contact, man, he hits him really hard.
Yeah, Marvin's playing for keeps. And there's a 1-2 that Minter did not take well. Mm-hmm. And again, Marvin's ridiculously motivated for this because of everything that's happened to him in his career to this point. Getting cheap paydays for a long time in dingy New England gyms. Getting screwed on his first trip to Philadelphia against Bobby Watts, getting screwed in his title fight with Vito Antifermo, not being invited to the USA Boxing Championships because he wouldn't sign away his promotional rights and basically his life to Don King. All these things have built up inside him. Getting jumped in the street by Darnell Wigfall. This is inside of him. This is a monster. He referred to it as the monster when he fought. He had an alter ego, which the same way a lot of guys just bring out something within them that is different when they get in the ring and that switch turns on. And the monster was unleashed, and he was hungry for the undisputed middleweight championship.
So unlike when Rocky went to Russia and turned the crowd in towards his favor, this does not go well for Marvin Hagler. He beats this guy. He takes his title. And the crowd not only does not embrace Marvin, but actively assaults this poor man.
You know, Goody always had the quote that we went in there, took the title, and they acted like we took something that didn't belong to us, and we had to run like thieves in the night, like we did something wrong. Again, because Hagler really brutalizes Minter, and especially the finish of the fight, Minter's just defenseless, and Marvin's just picking hooks and hooks and hooks off of him with ease. And it's just not – and you see he's walking Minter into just vicious counters, as Minter just having no success coming forward. The crowd, upon the decision, starts chucking full beer bottles into the ring, any objects they can find. And these are basically like soccer hooligans type of audience at Wembley. They were not happy that their guy who just became champion was not only beaten, but just destroyed, put up very little resistance. And they were not happy. They nearly rioted. It was close. And literally Hagler's camp and the Bobbies, who were there as security, shielded around him, like made a human shield around them to get them out of the ring. And he couldn't even get the belts in the ring. They had to present them to him in the locker room, which is so disrespectful.
Wow. So Joe Frazier, Marvin Hagler, who gets the award for most bitter boxer by the end of their career?
You know, Marvin was more bitter than anything about one particular thing we'll talk about later on, but generally seemed to enjoy his life in a lot of ways, which we'll talk about too when later on. I think Joe still has the win on that one.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, and I think they're owed their right to be angry about some things. You know, these were not easy lives that they lived. But so when I say, like, you know, commenting on the bitterness, it's not without its merit.
It's justified in many respects.
Sure. Hagler would begin the second longest continuous reign as undisputed middleweight champion, second only to Tony Zale, whose reign saw years of inactivity due to service in World War II. His first defense came against Venezuelan power puncher and future super middleweight champion, Fulgencio Albemejas.
But you're very cute for trying.
Oh, you even spelled it phonetically for me. Fulgencio Albemejas. Mejias.
Also known shortly as Fulio Bell.
Okay. So tell me about this fight here.
Showcase defense for Marvin in certain respects. Fulio Bell was the number one contender as rated because he had an undefeated record with a lot of knockouts. Not a great level of opposition as most of his fights taking place in his native Venezuela, but a guy who is known as a big-time puncher who presented a threat. And they did this at the Boston Garden where Hagler had a very big fan base as a New England-based fighter. And Obomias presented some problems. He was a very large middleweight. Like we said, he goes up in weight and actually becomes a world champion. Very long, very rangy, has a good, solid right hand, but it's very different when you step in there with the champion of the world after you haven't seen the best level of opposition, and the champion of the world is maybe the best fighter of his era and just goes in there, again, determined more than anything. There's always the saying, the wolf climbing the hill is hungrier than the wolf sitting on top of it. Because of everything he's been through, Marvin doesn't lose that hunger. Mm-hmm. Marvin is hungry, and he always used to compare himself to Pac-Man. He says he's going to eat everybody up like Pac-Man. And his desire to finish guys, to beat guys, is there through the entirety of the rest of his career. And Obomias just has the unfortunate distinction of being the first guy to try to take his title. And Marvin's one of the few guys who, when you would say they're going to take this title over my dead body, that you believe he's being literal when he says that.
Mm. As you can see, these two going at it on the video here. For those listening on the podcast, I mean, these guys are winging hooks at each other, and they are going toe-to-toe. This is not a lot of defense here. Go ahead.
One of the things we're seeing is one of the most underappreciated aspects of Marvin's game. He and maybe Alexis Arguello are two of the best guys who, whenever an opponent punches, there's an opening left, and they capitalize on it so fast.
Yeah. Well, moving on to the next bit here. So he gets a rematch with Antifuermo. That's what
Vito the Mosquito.
Yes, sir. Hang on.
That's still Fulio Bell, so we're going to go back to...
I hit the wrong button. There we go.
Mark's not exactly the most technically savvy guy.
Shut up. Making his HBO debut, Hagler looked nothing short of marvelous in a dominant display of boxing and power punching against a game, but outmatched.
Fulio Bell.
Yep. Anyway, moving on to Antifuermo. A determined Hagler carved up Vito from the outset behind his brilliant right jab. A headbutt initiated by Vito caused a cut on himself, and cornerman Freddie Brown nearly caused a disqualification by trying to demand his fighter be awarded the fight on a disqualification. But referee Davey Pearl made it clear that he didn't allow Vito to continue. He would lose by forfeit. When the bout resumed, Hagler remained sharp, controlling behind a jab and countering, dropping Vito and forcing Vito to quit due to a multitude of cuts that had developed.
Yeah, you can even see here if you're watching on the video, when you see Vito, there is a massive cut along Vito's hairline. Vito is actually one of the first guys who had the experimental surgery to try to toughen his skin a little bit. And also to toughen his skin, he stuck his head in a barrel of pickle brine, which is an old remedy the only other remedy that's similar to it is rubbing pine tar on your skin to toughen it up. And it did work to a certain extent. Vito had a semi-comeback in the mid-80s that ended with the loss to Matthew Hilton of Canada. But Vito, you know, even with the cuts, Vito's largely outmatched against Marvin. There's just not a lot he can do. And this fight is really illustrative of that, much more so than their first fight where Marvin kind of reined himself in and maybe fought conservatively, thinking he could do it that way. Now you see Marvin aggressive, and he's just taking it to Vito at every turn, just walking him into counter punches, shifting angles on him, battering him with that jab that's just so precise. And poor Vito is just not knowing what to do against this guy because he can't win against him on the inside. Right. He can't win against him on the outside. He's just totally outgunned here. And when he gets hit with that left hand that drops him in this fight, it's kind of a realization that this fight's going to go one way. And it's just a matter of time.
We're only in round one, and he looks like he's been through the windshield.
Yeah. And again, that's from a headbutt that Vito initiated, which, you know, Marvin, and not to sound, you know, whatever, but white fighters cut easier than black fighters. That's just a fact. Vito, in particular, cut very often and very easy. Marvin actually did have a proneness to cuts and swelling more so than most black fighters do. However, Vito was the one initiating butts, and that's never a good idea. especially against a fighter with a bald head, where the propensity for injury is much more sustainable. So you see Freddie Brown and the, I don't know what to call Panama Lewis. I'll just say his name. I hate even saying his name, but they're telling Davey Pearl that this is bogus. This cut was caused by Hagler's head. We're not going to tolerate this. This should be a disqualification. And Davey Pearl is saying, no, your guy caused this. This is insane. Get out of the ring. But Freddie Brown, who you see on camera, the inspiration for Mickey Goldmill in the Rocky movies, and rightfully so, loves his fighters, and he'll do anything he can to try to protect them and try to get them what they need. And we talked a little bit about Freddie on our last episode about Roberto Duran, who, for those who see the video stream, this is a hand casting that Roberto Duran did that I am proud to own. It was one of the coolest things I own. It is a limited piece, but it is a hand of stone by the hand of stone.
It's really cool. All right, so moving on from this, Hagler would produce arguably his most dominant performance against number one rated Brooklyn-based Syrian southpaw Mustafa Hamsho. In a total mismatch, Hagler wouldn't surrender a single round on the judges' scorecard and destroyed Hamsho's face, stopping him in 11 rounds.
That was a vicious performance. And again, Hamsho, another southpaw. Marvin fights a lot of southpaws. He's not afraid of them. Hamsho is his – the complete top of his head along his eyebrows are just destroyed with cuts. He takes over 100 stitches from this fight without winning a round and just being ridiculously beaten up. And his cornerman, Paddy Flood, who we talked about just a few minutes ago, stops the fight mercifully at the 11th round in the Rosemont Horizon in Illinois. And on it, this is broadcast on HBO. And at this point, Hagler's become fairly regular to the boxing public. And there's a lot of people thinking after seeing that, this guy might be the best fighter pound for pound in boxing.
So following this, Hagler signed a deal to fight three middleweights from the Kronk gym, culminating in a fight between Hagler and former welterweight and current junior middleweight champion Thomas the Hitman Hearns, one of our four kings. Injuries and postponements led to Hagler fighting Kronk's William Caveman Lee and disposing of him in less than 2 minutes. However, it was an argument with ABC Brass that was the real turning point in this bout. Hagler, whom had adopted the nickname Marvelous, had been told by ABC Brass they wouldn't refer to him as Marvelous Marvin Hagler. Once again, Hagler's attorney, Wainwright, took ABC's challenge and petitioned the courts to legally change the name Marvin Nathaniel Hagler to Marvelous Marvin Hagler. This wasn't a want in Hagler, but as Boston sports writer Ron Borges referred to it, a need within Hagler to be recognized for his talent. Hagler's first $1 million payday, here comes the money, was to come after his fight against Hearns, but a broken pinky finger forced Hearns out of the bout, and enraged Hagler, who claimed for $1 million he cut the pinky off. That's a man's man right there.
if we haven't established that already, Marvin's a man.
Yeah, for sure. This rage would simmer within Marvin and only get worse. Following a one-punch KO victory to defend his championship yet again in October of 1982 in a rematch with Obomayejas, Hagler was invited by Sugar Ray Leonard to a major press conference in November. Leonard had told Pat Petronelli that they were being invited to announce a fight between Hagler and Leonard, which would no doubt be arguably the biggest person in boxing at the time.
I need another beer for this one.
However, Leonard intentionally invited Hagler and his camp there to fool them when he announced his retirement from the ring. Jesus Christ, I can see why you guys hate Sugar Ray Leonard now. Bringing Hagler there for no other purpose than to be a clown in Leonard's circus where he was the ringmaster. Oh, well done, Pat. Well done.
That was. I got to give credit to George Kimball kind of for setting that up for me, who is the author of the tremendous book that we work a lot off of for this show, Four Kings, which is available on Amazon. The late George Kimball penned that one, and it's a great one. But yeah, this was bad. I remember an interview with Ray Leonard about it years later, and they asked him about it, and they're like, Ray, wasn't that kind of cold? And he goes, well, yeah, it was cold.
So as we see on the video screen, his next fight's against Tony Simpson. We've got some highlights here on the screen for people watching. But for those listening, tell me about this fight.
Again, now Marvin's fighting Simpson, who is the European middleweight champion, who had beaten Minter for that recognition in a fight that wasn't shown on the ITV because Simpson had a sponsorship that they didn't agree with and wouldn't show the fight, so they wouldn't show the sponsorship on camera. Simpson was a really strong, rugged middleweight who did a lot of weight training, trained above a bar in Leicester, England, where he was from, but was a really strong, good, solid pro. And again, Marvin's showing just how much better he is than everybody. He takes some punches from Simpson, which Marvin even acknowledged later on. Simpson hit him with a left hook that hurt him, but you never saw that in the fight. Marvin, just with the best poker face of all time and with the sturdiest chin, again, just works behind this brilliant jab, throwing combination after combination, moving laterally each way, switching stances to catch Simpson off guard, who really just can't figure Marvin out. And no matter what he does, he's eating tremendous counter punches, and his head's getting snapped back constantly. And he's a tough, tough guy. But this one, the Hominy knockout, incredible. Highlight real stuff. Real-life Clubber Lang. This knockout may be the most devastating looking and maybe the most Clubber Lang intent knockout you'll see from Marvin in that respect. Because the way Simpson is finished is just brutal. And I don't know that Marvin ever did a better finishing job on anybody than he did Simpson, who, again, such a tough guy, such a well-rounded pro, beat very good contenders on the way up, but has nothing to offer Marvin. And look at him get hit here. He's getting hit with an uppercut in the right hand. He's trying his best. Walks into a hook that Marvin just – and, again, another hook from Marvin, who's now in an orthodox stance, knocks Simpson down with a left hook after he put him off balance with a right hand. Long right hand. They're fighting inside. Hagler's covering using his shoulder. Right hand hurts him. Another right hand, another. And he has one more on the clip ready to go, but Simpson's already down, and he is legitimately out on his feet, not even recognizing the referees in front of him.
Pretty brilliant performance there.
And Sibbo, after the fight, as Sibbo, as his fans call him, the quote he had at the press conference was, "I didn't know anyone could do that to me." How good are you when somebody's saying that about you after you beat them up?
Yeah, that's a bad day at the office. While preparing for his next title defense, Hagler suffered a significant knee injury. Hagler had ruptured his tendon, which prevented him from moving laterally. Always seen as a skilled destroyer, the inability to move and pivot would be extremely detrimental to Hagler's style. Extensive rehabilitation allowed Hagler to regain some movement, but from this point onward, it was clear that Hagler would change stylistically. Which brings us to our last fight here, Marvelous Marvin Hagler versus Wilford Cyprian on HBO, May 27th, 1983. So tell me about this.
This is a significant turning point in the career of Marvin Hagler, because from everything we've watched and everything we've talked about, one of the best things Hagler does is his use of how quick he cuts angles to throw counter punches and to set guys up for the knockouts. When you lose your ability to move laterally and you have to move forward and backward, you're not going to fight anywhere near as effectively. And even though Marvin did his rehab and did everything he could to regain that, it was very obvious in how he fought from then on that his style had changed. He became less of a fluid boxer and more of an aggressive banger. And that matters in the long run. And I think the thing with Marvin is the Simpson fight is probably the last we really see Marvin in his true prime. And I think against Wilford, he has some ability, but he's fighting a guy who is in this fight by virtue of pulling off a tremendous upset against a guy who everyone thought was going to fight Marvin, Frank the Animal Fletcher. And Frank Fletcher, though a top-rated contender in the 80s, always seemed to choke in the big stages as he loses a title contention fight to Cyprian. He's going to lose one later on to Juan Roldan, who will go on to challenge Hagler. And Fletcher just had this thing where he couldn't step up in the big game. Cyprian had lived every boxer's nightmare when he accidentally killed a man in the ring, a guy from New York named Willie Klassen. So Cyprian has had some ups and downs in his career, and he's not really seen as a threat to Hagler, but there are some questions. Marvin's had a significant injury. How's he going to look after this? And if you watch Marvin in this fight, they're still bouncing his toes. He still throws solid, solid punches, but there's not the quick angle cuts that he makes, and he looks more off balance when he moves away. And the reason being that knee injury is significant, and it's more significant than they ever let people on to believe. It's always said, and I think it's more prone now, like people who follow MMA and follow the career of somebody like a Shogun Hua, once your knees start to go, it's downhill completely from there. And people, Shogun Hua lost basically both of his knees at a certain point. and he couldn't do road work. He couldn't move. And a lot of Shogun striking movement was based on how quick he could change angles and hit a guy from a spot they didn't see coming. I think you see a similar thing in Hagler here, where he's not as quick to get out of exchanges. He's not as quick to turn the corner and hit a guy where they can't hit him. And even though he's still great, and it says a lot about him that despite that injury, he's still able to perform at a pound-for-pound level, there's definitely a change here. And I think this that we've seen Marvin now in his prime, and that's starting to pass him by due to injury.
So at the conclusion of this fight, which ends in the fourth round by KO, he retains the ring middleweight title. He wins the inaugural IBF middleweight title, and he'll he'll go on to have several classic fights, not the least of which are with some of our kings of boxing here, Roberto Duran.
He's also, by virtue of winning this fight, the first guy to hold the WBA, WBC, and IBF championships together, as well as being recognized as the lineal world heavyweight champion, or middleweight champion, excuse me.
And he will end his career at 62 wins and 3 losses, a total of 67 fights. His final fight will be against Sugar Ray Leonard, but that is a story for another day, Pat.
Yeah, it is. And boy, oh boy, is that going to be an episode. All of them are going to be episodes, but yeah, we're talking 4 of the greatest fighters in history, not just from one era, not just from a period in history. These 4 guys, pound for pound, are guys who everybody recognizes as some of the best. And we had an era where they were active in their prime, all fought each other multiple times in some instances. And when people talk about the golden eras of boxing, for a lot of people, this is the last golden era where you had 4 pound for pound greats all floating around those same weight classes who came together to produce, gosh, how many fights between them? 3 for Leonard Duran, 2 for Leonard Hearns. That's 8. Hagler Leonard, Hagler Hearns. That many fights against each other through the course of 1980 to 1989. And you just don't get that anymore. Even in the 90s when we had Felix Trinidad, Oscar De La Hoya, Shane Mosley, Fernando Vargas, all these guys floating around, we never got all of them against each other. We did get a lot, but it's something that was so special and so unique, and I'm so happy that we're covering it. And yes, Showtime is doing a documentary series for Kings, 4 episodes over 4 weeks, but there's not enough in 1 hour of 4 to cover everything that went on through this. And that's why we're doing the episode format that we're doing. We're doing an episode on Duran up to the point he fights in this round robin system. Same thing on Hagler, same thing on Leonard, same thing on Hearns. There's so much ground to cover here with so many things going on that we want to give you the full picture. We want to encompass everything, and not the least of which are the fights themselves between these greats. And we want to put you there in that time capsule with us that goes back and, for me, gets to enjoy reliving this. From Mark, in certain instances, he's reliving it, but he's also seeing things from a different perspective. And we want to share that with you guys and hope there's an interest there and that you guys like what we're doing and maybe rekindle some interest in you to go back and watch these fights and these fighters and see true artistry at its finest form.
Well said, Pat. And that is the conclusion of Chapter 2 of the 4 Kings of Boxing podcast review. Our next installment will be, we got to skip July. I'm going away for 2 weeks and we just
vacation with the family. Ugh.
It was hard to cram in with everyone's schedules more of these things, but we will do the Chapter 3 on Sugar Ray Leonard on August 25th. In the meantime, you know, who can't get enough Pat Mullen? Not me, and I'll tell you that for sure. So before I go away,
either.
We will have Pat on one more time in the month of July. Him and Chris Bailey and I will be doing the Mania of WrestleMania 3, and that is currently scheduled tentatively, and aren't all things tentative, Thursday, July 15th in the morning. So we'll go.
So ahead. I won't be blackout drunk 9 times out of 10 in the morning.
Well, hopefully not. That's going to be it for that. Like I said, in August, though, we'll start getting more of these shows back in there. We've got we're going to double up and do the Mania of WrestleMania 4 and 5.
The Trump Plaza Manias.
Yeah, it's a 2-year story. It needs to be told together. So yes, we're going to do that August 11th.
That's, you like it.
Yeah. The cream of the crop. That'll be August 11th in the morning. And then it's been a podcast many years in the making. We talked about it. We brought it back up again when we re-aired the Warrior version of this. Who knows how many of these we're going to actually do, but I at least wanted to do this one more time. Unsolved Mysteries of Wrestling, Ric Flair's WWF run.
By the way, taking suggestions on that topic, if there's something that you guys don't understand why it didn't work or what have you, we're open to suggestion on this. That was one we thought of years ago that we never got to pursue for whatever reason. We did the Ultimate Warriors WWF career. We're going to do why Flair and the WWF may not necessarily have panned out the way people thought. But yeah, we're excited for that one because it's been one in the works for a while, and now we actually get to do it and share it with you guys.
Yep. I think there's at least one more of these I would like to do. That's at least on my wish list. It's going to be a weird one. You're going to be like, what mystery is there? Not so much a mystery, but years ago, and you're a 411 guy, so you remember In Defense Of, which I stole for On Trial. it was a brilliant column, especially for me who tends to like to get in the financial weeds of things. It's a wonder I didn't go to business school and instead became a social worker.
Hey, Mark, you're a religious guy, right?
Go on.
Yeah, just saying, you know, money and, you know.
No, for Pete's sake. For Pete's sake. You. Anyway, Diesel's 1998-5 title run. Because the contention on Diesel has always been, oh, he was the least drawing champion ever. He was this, he was that. But I think there's, you know, and I remember the column kind of pointing to this. With Diesel, there's some contextual things you have to take into account. So I think it would be a fun story to tell.
Why not? I was watching for a lot of 1995. So yeah, you know what? Big Sexy, you're up. We'll do episode 3 is Diesel's 1995 run and the why and the how and the what possibly.
Right. And I think, you know, we don't have to do an entire show In Defense Of Diesel's run. I don't want to take away from the guy that did the column.
I'm not necessarily defending it.
Right. I think it deserves at least a discussion. So we'll do that. That'll be fun to schedule, but we'll get to it when we get to it. In the meantime, in between time, it has been a busy few days for me. On Monday, I did 2 shows. I reviewed Luca with my kids and Robert Winfrey and Alexis Haina. Then in the evening, I reviewed the first volume of the Sweet Tooth series with Ronnie Adams. And then we talked about it for 5 minutes, and then we spent the rest of the time discussing why I say things are just fine. Ronnie Adams had things to say to me. So no, we had a good time, me and him. Earlier today, Chris Bailey and I reviewed Hell in the Cell. That'll be up in the archives tomorrow. Are you okay?
No, you said Hell in the Cell.
Yeah. Tomorrow, myself and Jesse Starcher will review Fear Factory, Aggression Continuum, Ronnie Adams.
Just so you guys know, none of the grudge matches in this system are decided by a roll-up.
yes, sir. We brought that up once or twice. So yeah, we're reviewing the new Fear Factory. Yeah, we've reviewed a lot of silly albums lately, a lot of goofy ones, but we're finally getting back to some real metal. So this week we've got Fear Factory, Aggression Continuum, and then Ronnie Adams will be back, and we'll be talking Sweet Tooth season 1 from Netflix on Friday. Myself and Jeff Sloboda are we're taking on a new thing. I added a new podcast because I don't have enough. We are doing something called Triple Feature, which is basically like I get asked to do a lot of different movie reviews, and not all of them deserve the full damn you Hollywood treatment.
Not all of them deserve reviews, so
well, not all of them deserve reviews, but certainly don't deserve the damn you Hollywood treatment where we do deep dives, you know, neat the news about the thing, there's the history of it, all of that. So instead, there's a lot of movies that are currently streaming to various platforms, a lot of new movies, movies that in a different era would have made it to the cinema. So with that said,
by different era, you mean 2 years ago
before the pandemic. So, I want to take those bigger budget feature pictures that went straight to streaming. And I want to talk about them, but I don't need to do an hour long discussion on just one of them. And I want to get more of these in as I can. So with that being said, we're doing Triple Feature, which is we take 3 movies from any streaming service. And we talk about them for about 10 to 20 minutes a piece. For you know, an hour total. And our inaugural show is Friday night. So Jeff Sloboda and I will be talking Awake from Netflix, as well as The Ice Road, which actually comes out that day, June 25th. And Infinite on Paramount Plus, which everyone said sucked diddly ucks. So But I enjoy talking about shitty movies, so that'll be fun. In the meantime, Pat, I'm not even going to ask you because I already know what the answer is. The answer is no. I only have eyes for you. So we will see you again soon. Thanks for doing this with me. For everybody else, hope you've enjoyed our Four Kings of Boxing Chapter 2 Marvin Hagler show.
He's not wrong.
Until then, be well, be safe, and behave.